This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we explore how the advances in pain management for children have reduced their suffering. Plus, we'll take a look at the world's smallest heart pump and how it saves lives. But first, what's new in the world of cancer diagnosis? Cancer is the leading cause of death in the United States, second only to heart disease, and the way we diagnose it in the laboratory in this country is about to change. Dr. Robert Corona, professor and chair of pathology at Upstate Medical University, is here with us to tell us all about it. Welcome, Dr. Corona. Thanks for coming in today.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you.
So first, I understand that you just returned to Upstate from working in the private sector, and you were working with advanced technology. Tell us about that first.
Well, as a result of my experience here at Upstate back in the mid-90s, working with telemedicine and what we called medical informatics, the industry got interested in what I was doing and some of the things I used computers for. So a local local company asked me to come over and get involved in their product development. And they developed mostly products that were based on optical-mechanical technology, and they wanted to take advantage of the processor that's in a computer to use in their new medical equipment.
So we can say you were at Welch Allen,
a
well-known company here in Syracuse.
So I was at Welch Allen, very fortunate to work for Bill and Lou Allen, who were the grandsons of the founder of Welch Allen, and had just a wonderful experience there for almost 16 years of doing product development and working with the regulatory department. So great experience, but I wanted to apply some of the business principles that I learned there back here at Upstate, where I'm happy to be.
So let me understand, though, before you went to Welch Allen, you were here, as you said, in the 90s. What was your role there then?
So I trained here from 1987 through 1990, the end of 91, as a pathologist and the neuropathologist. Went 1 year to Albany Med and came back and worked as a faculty member, neuropathologist. But as soon as I got back here, I was bitten by the technology bug and developed a telemedicine and medical informatics program that was nationally recognized, quite successful, and that's how I ended up meeting Bill Allen.
Okay, I want to understand first, when you say a neuropathologist, what exactly did you do?
So we're subspecialists in the field of pathology, and we're subspecialists in the area of the nervous system. So that would include disorders of the brain, spinal cord, nerve, and muscle.
So you were involved in the diagnosis in the laboratory of people. They would take some kind of a tissue sample, and then you were involved in diagnosing whether they had these diseases.
Exactly. An example was our telepathology program that we started here. There were neurosurgeons in Binghamton, our sister campus, but there were not neuropathologists. So we had a robotic microscope in Binghamton that would view the slides, the tissue slides, and we would be here in Syracuse observing them on a television screen and making the diagnosis. Most of the involvement is in cancer, brain cancers, brain tumors, some other things, but neuropathology is largely a diagnosis of brain cancers when the patients are alive. When the patients have expired, we do work with the forensics and some of the autopsy material.
So that hence kind of led you to, I mean, in a way, or you said simultaneously, you became very interested in this idea of using technology, and you used it, as you said, to develop this program that you said was recognized nationally, at least, if not worldwide. Tell us a little bit about that program, briefly.
Yeah, it was recognized by the Smithsonian Institution as one of the leading technology initiatives in the country, and then internationally because we had done work with Israel and some people in Canada on using our technology to transfer information and to proctor surgeries and to do a bunch of other different
things. So give me an example of something you could do using this technology. In other words, you could do a surgery in one country and other people could be observing it. Could they be also participating in some way in another country?
Yeah, at the time we did it, we didn't have the Da Vinci robots, or we didn't have robotic surgery. It was just experimental, and the military had it. So we had done some teleproctoring, telepresence surgery, it's called, where the surgeon would be in one place and the patient would be in the other. And that at that time it was an animal experimental. But as time has gone on, now we have robots that do surgery. It's pretty commonplace. So the surgeon could technically be anywhere. We did the same thing with pathology. If the microscope was robotically controlled, the microscope could be anywhere in the world, and the pathologist could be remote to that, and they could be looking at the tissue and operating the microscope and rendering a diagnosis.
Talk about global medicine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really drawing from the resources worldwide.
Correct.
I mean, the potential is incredible.
Yeah, it really is. You know, nowadays we have our radiologists can be anywhere in the world, and they send their images all over to be read. It's coming soon to pathology.
Well, I want to talk more about that. I just want to understand, or help us understand, with cancer in particular, you know, the pathology is always, I mean, you're always waiting for the quote-unquote path report after kind of a biopsy.
Right.
So why is early diagnosis so critical, I mean, with cancer, and what's your role in that, Jennifer?
Well, there's a number of reasons why it's important to get it early. Certainly the most important is because it's usually confined or isolated. So if it's not penetrated through certain anatomical structures, if it's not gotten into blood vessels and has a conduit, a portal to go to the rest of the body or lymph nodes, that kind of stuff, that's why it's key. So if you can extract it surgically and then, you know, use some augmentative therapy like chemotherapy or radiation therapy, the patients do extremely well. The exciting thing about pathology now is we're getting more precise in the diagnosis. So instead of describing a tumor based solely on how it looks under a microscope, we get into the genetic components of it, and we can tell the people that treat the cancers, more specifically that people with this gene deletion, for instance, will not respond to this chemotherapy, or people with this type of pattern will respond well to this drug.
And so that's all through the analysis of the so-called slide or the tissue sample?
The tissue, or sometimes fluids, or aspirates, or core needle biopsies. So we're getting better at giving very personalized therapies to patients based on being more precise with our diagnosis.
I understand these days there's more and more what they call targeted chemotherapy or targeted therapy for cancer. But what I never understood that you just elaborated on was that the pathologists play a key role here in helping the oncologist to understand more about the nature of the cancer.
That's correct. So, for instance, if let's take a breast or a prostate cancer, they would have certain proteins on the surface of the cancer, and we can mark for these proteins with some of our special potions, our stains, we call them. And so if the tumor has a certain characteristic protein on the surface, it might be more responsive to a certain therapy or less responsive to a certain therapy. So if we tell the surgeon this patient has positivity for this particular protein, they know that they can use a specific drug or a specific approach that's been proved to be more successful.
That's incredible. I had never known that the pathologist played that key a role, or that we had the capability at this point in understanding the cell structure and the efficacy of certain treatments. That's really, really exciting.
It is. It's very exciting. And it's getting more exciting because as we have computers kind of infiltrate into pathology, we get better and better at characterizing tissue. We use our naked eye often to count, for instance, replicating cells. It takes a long time. You know, it's fraught with human error, but a computer can scan across a slide and count the number of replicating cells in a split second.
So take us back. Help us understand currently. I mean, I don't know about currently, because you may already have put some of these more advanced techniques into practice, but at one point we were using, somebody would take a biopsy, take some tissue, put it on a slide, literally on a glass slide of some kind, stain it in some way, and look at it physically under a microscope.
That's
Is that correct? That was the kind of bread and butter of what pathologists were doing. So how is it changing?
It's still the majority of how we do things, although we get more sophisticated with a special staining of the tissue that we do, and we still look at it under the microscope. But there are all kinds of exciting new ways things are happening. We would take tissue and run it through what we call flow cytometers to have a computer actually look at the way tissue is characterized based on certain markers that we attach to it. There are things that we can do where we we hybridize, we actually bond certain proteins with antibodies, and they have little fluorescent tags on them, and we can look at that under a microscope and say that this patient has this gene or doesn't have this gene or the certain protein. The other exciting thing is radiology about a decade ago got rid of its film, like we've gotten rid of our consumer film cameras for the most part. Well, pathology still uses glass under a slide. The new systems are going to scan those glass slides back in the laboratory away from the pathologist, and the images at high resolution will be sent to a pathologist on a computer screen at high resolution so that they can observe the tissue.
Hence this issue of the naked, so-called naked eye. I know it's greatly magnified, but it's no longer left simply to the human eye, basically, to analyze.
Yeah, it's not on the microscope anymore. It's on the computer, and we have all the power of computer processing to help us with the diagnosis. The neat thing is I envision that our little iPads or our tablet pads will become the glass slide of the future, and so you could envision that an oncologist would walk into a patient's room and say, I have an image of your tumor, the tissue, and that I can show you. Here's the cancer, and here's the margin, and you can see that the cancer is not anywhere near the margin. That visualization to a patient who just had been diagnosed with a prostate or a breast cancer, to see visually that their cancer is not at the margin, that they cut it all out, I think would be extraordinarily powerful.
Right, but that's phenomenal. And obviously as a patient communication, doctor-patient communication tool, education tool would be incredible. But you're not suggesting that an iPad would be a way of actually getting involved in this whole process of diagnosis?
Absolutely.
You
because
are.
all the iPad is an extension of a computer,
right?
And it's a computer itself,
right?
So if the imagery has been processed and put into the computer system on a server, it can be displayed on these retina displays that are on iPads, which are a very high resolution, sometimes exceed the ability of the human eye.
So you're suggesting you no longer have to go into a laboratory if you're a pathologist. You can be anywhere on the beach.
We're hoping so.
you can be down in whatever the
Keys. We can be sitting right next to our radiology colleagues.
having a mojito on the Keys, right,
yeah.
And doing the diagnosis. Well, that's incredible. But what's most exciting to me is the fact that this type of technology will enable you to more carefully or closely or accurately make these diagnoses and hence the kind of targeted treatment that would follow.
I mean, I think we're coming into the age of personalized medicine instead of this what we call a shotgun approach, you know, just trying to get every cell we can with toxic chemotherapy and radiation therapy. We're getting better at helping be more precise with the therapy, which is really exciting.
Is some of the basic science research that's being done, I know some of it is actually being done here at Upstate in terms of, you know, some of the genetic components of different types of cancer cells, is that also helping in terms of what you do?
Absolutely. I've only been here a month, and I'm just kind of learning what everybody's doing again. But, you know, this institution is phenomenal. With our new cancer center coming on board, we're going to hopefully be, one of the leading centers, certainly in the region, if not in the nation.
So you are also, are you involved in some kind of a study as well going forward?
Not presently. I've been talking with the individual researchers at the Cancer Center about participating in some studies coming up. I'd like to reestablish the neuropathology training program that we had here, which was where I trained, and if we are successful in doing that, we'll be studying brain tumors.
I mean, how do you see, with all of the stuff that's going on right now, first of all, I read somewhere a term called molecular imaging. Is that something that is in your field, or did I get that wrong?
Well, it could be. I don't think it's in anybody's field right now. We do molecular diagnostics. We have a laboratory. One of the things I talked to you about was when we tag tumors and look at them under a microscope, a lot of that uses a molecular technique, or you use various molecular techniques.
Which means what? You're looking specifically at the molecules,
right,
of the cell?
Right. It's a broad brush term that encompasses a lot of different technologies, but it's more sophisticated than just staining with enzymes and certain dyes that we use to stain tissue. But what's happening is radiology is getting better and better at looking at smaller and smaller tissue, right? They're getting down to resolutions in microns, and we look at resolutions in microns under a microscope. So you almost see a convergence of the two specialties, and I often think that there could be a medical imaging specialist in the future that understands radiology and understands pathology really well. And General Electric is looking at injecting molecular tracers into patients and then looking to see where the tracers go to help diagnose certain cancers and other disorders too. So the field of molecular diagnostics, it's called, is quite exciting.
Yeah, it sounds like, my God, it sounds like every day something new is evolving. It also strikes me, that illusion that you made, or this idea of having a specialist who joins two subspecialties, this notion of partnership being so important, that you really can't work in isolation. I mean, I would think that pathologists very often in the past, this is probably an unfair image, but, you know, there they were with their white lab coats sitting in the laboratory looking in the basement, no light. They're looking under microscopes, at slides. But today it sounds to me like there's really a need for this constant interaction, such as what you were doing with the whole telemedicine thing, not only in terms of your institution, but even on a larger scale. I mean, this idea of partnerships seem to be very important, like what will happen in our new cancer center.
Exactly. I think the patients benefit immensely from multiple points of view. For instance, when we do conferences and we have the participation of the neurologists and the neurosurgeons and then myself as the neuropathologist, the learning experience is so much richer for everybody involved. And I think the diagnostic accuracy and the therapeutic intervention that happens is so much better when you have a bunch of experts looking at an individual case.
Yeah, and it also strikes me that this whole notion of translational research, where you have people who are actually doing the basic science and then can take it into the, you know, clinical application, that's a lot of what I think, isn't that kind of what you were doing in a way at Welch Allyn?
Exactly. We would take, the engineers and the clinicians would work together to have a concept, and then we'd bring out a prototype, and we needed to do clinical investigations to make sure that what we designed is really what the clinicians wanted. And often we were off the mark, so we needed to do these clinical validations, and then we'd bring it back, and then we had to prove to the Food and Drug Administration that it was safe and efficacious. So it was interesting. I always got to work with really good clinicians out in the field.
Well, all I can say is we're very lucky to have you back.
Thank
and
you.
All the expertise that you came to Welch Allyn with and that you've now brought back to Upstate will be beneficial to everyone in this region. So thanks so much for being here. My guest has been Dr. Robert Corona. He's professor and chair of pathology at Upstate Medical University. Next, how have advances in pain management for children changed lives? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's registered dietitian Terry Podolak is here for this week's Healthy Eats segment, and she's here to talk about a very favorite subject for all, ice cream. Hey, Terry, how you doing?
Hi, Linda. Good, thanks.
So what is it about ice cream that makes it so attractive to so many of us?
I think it's just the idea, you know, it's summertime and we all just want to be with our family and friends and going to that ice cream stand and just cooling down with a nice dish or cone of wonderful creamy ice cream.
You know, there so many cravings around ice cream. I'm not even sure if it's the desire for the tradition of going to the ice cream stand, like you said. I mean, many of us, for example, have all these memories, childhood memories about ice cream.
Yeah, including myself. I think ice cream is one of the most craved foods. Just the idea of being with family and that summertime ritual. My favorite ice cream sundae, and I can just taste it right now as we talk, is called a Mexican sundae. So I just love going with my friends, maybe riding a bike up to the ice cream shop or going at night after dinner.
So. I have some of those same memories. Excuse me. If you really have to have ice cream, though, I mean, can there be some nutritious, you know, what can be the best choices so that it doesn't damage our waistlines too terribly?
Well, you know, I'm a big advocate of pushing nuts. So if you're not allergic to nuts, having some protein and you know, adding the nuts, I really like to...
So that enhances the nutrition.
Yes, yeah. You know, it can provide a little bit of dairy and, again, just something fun to do and to eat.
But is frozen yogurt or sherbet a better choice from a standpoint of weight? You know, calories, that kind
of thing. Yeah, I'm just big on portion control. So if you like the taste of sherbet, want something that is not higher in fat, or same with a frozen yogurt, yes, those are nice choices too. But if you really want some regular ice cream, I'm just big on the portion control issue. And, you know, don't be embarrassed or afraid to ask for small or even toddler size and eat it with just full attention and awareness. I'm in shock at the size of some of the ice cream cones that we get now. So,
speaking of cones, should you choose a cone over a cup or a cup over a cone?
Again, I think it's preference, too. So if you go to an ice cream stand and you're really hungry, then, you know, you're probably going to get a bigger size and a bigger cone. And so, and again, just when you're eating that, just be very aware of how your stomach is feeling. If you're full, you don't have to finish the cone. But again, just simply a matter of, I think, preference. If you are watching your weight, I heard some of those cones, are quite large. So.
They're not only large, but they also have a lot of extra things. I've seen chocolate-dipped cones and chocolate-dipped with sprinkle cones. So
I'd recommend maybe sharing that with somebody.
If you want to share. I don't know. Many people I know don't want to share their ice cream. What about things like toppings, though? Are there good nutritional? You mentioned nuts is one choice.
Yeah.
But are there other types of toppings that can enhance the nutritional value?
Maybe some nice dark chocolate if they offer that. You know, there a lot of people I know get the sprinkles and the cookies. So again, just a once in a while treat would be okay.
In the little bit of time we have left, how many servings of ice cream would you recommend a week?
A couple times a week, you know. And again, portion is the key.
And does it make sense to try homemade ice cream?
Oh, I think it's a wonderful thing to try. It's a wonderful just to do with your family or friends.
And do you have a good choice for that?
Yes, we do. We've got a recipe.
Oh, and that you brought us a recipe.
Yes.
Okay, it looks like a great, very scrumptious recipe. We're going to have it on our website.
Great.
Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Helping a child in pain can be extremely challenging for any parent, especially when it occurs as part of a medical emergency. But there is help for this difficult situation. And here with us as part of our continuing series, Peds to Parents, is Dr. Richard Cantor, Professor of Pediatrics and Emergency Medicine and the Director of the Pediatric Emergency Department, and Rachel Hannon, Certified Child Life Specialist at Upstate Medical University, to fill us in on all the recent advances in pain management, especially during a visit to a pediatric emergency department. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I can't think of a more frightening or challenging situation than bringing my child to a pediatric ED, especially with an emergency and a child in pain. But we've had some really significant recent advances in helping. Can you fill us in on that?
The most important thing to realize is that up to 15 to 20 years ago, there was actually a concept that children didn't feel pain the same way that adults did. And number two, that the medications that could be used for adults, for pain medication, were dangerous for children. This is all gone. Everyone understands that this is a bad belief. And subsequently, we've arrived at the point now where we are experts in both family care and alleviation of pain. With the acquisition of child life specialists, we can start out with more non-traditional mechanisms that I'll let Rachel talk about and move into more drug therapies later. We've really made advances. The era of screaming children in the PEDS emergency department is over.
Wow.
Our goal is a quiet room with a controlled environment, a happy family, and a child that's either distracted or sedated and has no bad memory of the event.
I want to get into all the details of how you achieve that as we go on, but starting with the very the outset of an emergency, you know, I'd like to understand if you had to call 911, let's say your child had fallen out a window or something like that, or whatever, something pretty extreme, are these advances also have been carried through to the EMTs and people who come?
Yes, the most simplest thing to do was get them comfortable with giving basically analgesics for the children. Give them, frankly, morphine if they've broken a leg. And that's all set. The paramedics
are
incredibly comfortable with that. And they're starting to develop a sensitivity to the non-traditional methods with calming the child as well.
Okay, so let's take us through the drill. So I've arrived, either by ambulance or not,
right,
to a pediatric emergency room. What's the first thing that happens?
You are placed in a room and then you meet Rachel.
Really? That's the first thing. So tell us about your role, Rachel. I understand that a lot of the pain is related to anxiety. Not always, but at least a part of it.
It can be. It's definitely a huge factor. I mean, kids, it's a lot harder to assess kids' pain when they're anxious because it's hard to sort of figure out whether the pain is because of the anxiety or because of the injury.
Or the parents' anxiety, for that matter.
Or the parents' anxiety, and that does factor, you know, a lot into kids' anxiety. Kids really feed off what their parents' behavior is. So kind of orienting kids to the room and orienting parents to the room and explaining kind of what the steps are and keeping them informed about what's going to happen can really lessen that anxiety and then give us a better chance to assess the child's pain and really get an idea of how we can help that pain.
Is it important to establish some kind of a rapport or relationship with the child? I mean, obviously it's going to be age-related. If you've got an infant, it's quite a different thing. But if you've got like an 18-month-old or even a 2-year-old, is there?
Yeah, absolutely. So establishing that rapport is really important. You're going to be able to get a better idea of what they're feeling and what they're going through, but also changing the environment to make it more child-friendly. So we have things like toys, we have things that these kids have at home, so it's not so uncomfortable. It sort of normalizes the environment for them. And that alone can kind of change the whole dynamic of the room.
What role does distraction play? I know in my own life, raising my children, if something was bothering them, quite often I try to distract them.
So with some other object,
developmental task, toy, something like that.
Yeah, distraction is huge, and that's really a big part of my job is providing distraction during procedures. You know, initially for procedures, the most important thing is preparing kids for what's going to happen. When kids know what is happening and what they're expected to do, what the behavior is that's expected of them, they tend to react a lot better than if we just surprise them.
So you've calmed them down in a sense, or you've made them more comfortable. Mm-hmm. They begin to trust you.
Yes.
What's the next thing that happens? Let's just give an example of they've gashed their hand or their chin. They've gashed their chin riding a skateboard or a bike, and they're going to need stitches. So what happens?
It's a perfect example. And in brief, Rachel will come out of the room and say one of a few things. One, I don't think we'll have to worry about this child. He can compensate for what's necessary. Two, we can just numb the area, possibly with some cream or an injection like a Novocaine injection. Or sometimes Rachel will say to me, you're going to have to sedate this child. I really can't get above the fear factor. That intertwining and collegiality between child life and the healthcare providers is invaluable. And I got to give Rachel a lot of credit. It took years to convince us that we just shouldn't hold them down. I have seen children that I would have bet my home could not handle the stresses of the event. And I'll go back in the room and I don't hear a word. And there's a child that Rachel's reading to or seeing a video on an iPad and someone else is sewing their face.
Wow.
And it's
that's really
butter.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing thing to see.
So the psychological or the non-pharmacologic interventions with regard to pain really, really do make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, they help kids cope. We can give them some techniques to help them cope that distraction. Sometimes we're doing guided imagery. Sometimes we're doing deep breathing. So that all really plays a part in helping them to cope through that procedure, as well as giving them tools for when they leave us.
You need to know also that child life is a very valued component in the inpatient service as well. It's development in the ED. This is within the last 5 to 7 years, and it's It's like anything else. How do we ever live without it?
Once you have it. So tell me about the kinds of analgesics or other kind of pharmacologic things that you've begun to do with children.
It's hard to say this, and I'm part of the history of the field, and I'm getting too old, but we used to take kids with broken legs and give them Tylenol. I'm serious. And now we are trained to give the medications, and they are the following. You can use morphine. You can use some non-steroidals. You can use agents that completely sedate a child so he doesn't have any sensation of fear or pain. And we have new mechanisms to deliver it. Their traditional shot in the arm has been replaced by feasibly an IV. Now, an IV sounds stringent, but it really gives you a controlled sedation. But the newest mechanism that we have is intranasal medication. We can give morphine or other opioids that you need. We can also give Valium-type medicines to calm kids. And if it's deemed necessary for us to do that, we can completely control the environment and have a child have no memory of the event.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm here with Dr. Richard Cantor, Director of the Pediatric Emergency Department, and Rachel Hannon, Certified Child Life Specialist. We're talking about all the advances in pain in children in the pediatric ED, pain management. So, okay, basically you can control the pain with things like lidocaine?
Yes, you can give injections topically, you know, just like to numb the wound. We have a cream form of that we use. Most children, if I can get the area numb and Rachel can distract them from the fear of five people hovering over you, it flows beautifully. The other extreme is someone who's got a very bad injury or a bad laceration that's going to take time. We do a professional history and physical, put them, quote, under. And when they're done, half hour later, they go home from the ED.
How do you help the parents, though?
So it's the same as with kids. It's really preparing them for what's going to happen, what the child's behavior may look like when we give them this medication. What are their eyes going to do? What are they going to talk? Are they going to say funny things? So really preparing them and giving them the tools to help their child cope. So encouraging them to kind of put their game face on when they are feeling anxious themselves, or if they can't handle it, saying it's okay to step out of the room if
it's
too much.
But in some sense, you try to keep them as part of the team.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes.
Make them part of the
team.
That's
going to reduce the child's anxiety significantly to have that caregiver present.
Right.
There's another thing here that's as expeditious that I want you to know about. If a child, for example, breaks his arm and he comes in, he gets wheeled back by ambulance or from the parents, we used to have to put him in a room, start an IV, and give the medication, the morphine as such. Now we can walk over to the child with a nasal spray and immediately alleviate the pain so that the x-ray that's going to happen, they don't have discomfort and pain, and they are often sedated enough that we can put an IV in painlessly and take care of the rest of the problem. I don't want to hear crying in my emergency department.
That's really amazing, actually, especially in light of what you've described, the history being just the opposite. I actually read an article in preparation for this interview of where they actually, in some hospital, put a child in a straitjacket in order to do the procedure, which is sounds like the dark ages. Yeah. So we've come a long, long way.
Definitely.
And again, knowing children feel pain, knowing they can tolerate the medications, knowing the value of child life feeds into what you and I have talked about before. We don't just deliver medical care in the PEDS emergency department. We deliver family-oriented care. As you already said eloquently in the beginning of the spot, we treat the mom, the dad, the family, the other siblings, and the existing problems.
Well, I can't tell you how reassuring that is, I think, for people who are listening who may have the occasion, sadly enough, to bring their child to the pediatric emergency room, but obviously knowing the kind of care that they will be awaiting them will be extremely reassuring. So I want to thank you so much for coming in once again. My guests have been Dr. Richard Cantor, Professor of Pediatrics and Emergency Medicine, and he's the Director of the Pediatric Emergency Department, and Rachel Hannon, Certified Child Life Specialist, both from Upstate Medical University. Next, how has the world's smallest heart pump saved lives? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for August 12th. Talk to the pros. Long-term stress can cause serious health problems or make existing ones worse. Talking to a doctor about the symptoms you're experiencing can help you determine if they're due to stress or the result of another health problem. Moreover, doctors are full of suggestions on how to effectively manage your stress levels and have resources to help you begin de-stressing your life. If you're experiencing health problems that may be related to stress, schedule an appointment with a physician or health professional this week. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. There's a new heart pump being used at Upstate, and here to tell us more about it is Dr. Hani Kosman. He is the director of the Cardiac Catheterization Laboratory at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Kosman. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So, what is this new device?
Well, it's a device that pumps the blood for your heart when your heart can't pump the blood. So, it's kind of like a small corkscrew that pumps the blood out of the main pumping cavity of the heart, called the left ventricle, into the aorta. It's very tiny. It's about the size of a AAA battery, or
wow,
maybe two of them put end to end. And we pass it up through an artery in the leg up to the heart and across the aortic valve, and that pumps the blood from the left ventricle into the aorta. And the aorta is pretty well the main artery that supplies blood to the whole body. So if your heart can't pump for you, it'll pump the blood. Fancy name for it is a LVAD, or a left ventricular assist device.
I think this is amazing as a layperson to hear about a little tiny device like that that can basically take the place of your heart.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't take the place, but it is an assistive device.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't replace the heart completely, but it pumps near normal amount of cardiac output so that the blood will circulate to the rest of your body if your heart can't pump the blood.
Okay, so the first question obviously is, why would you need this? Who needs this, and when?
Well, there's basically two types of patients. I mean, they're both groups are very ill patients. One type of patient is the patient that comes in with a big heart attack, where most of their heart muscle was knocked out by a blocked artery from a blood clot, and they tend to not be able to maintain their blood pressure or cardiac output. The state is called cardiogenic shock. So in those cases, we'd put the tube in. We can insert it very quickly within about 5 minutes all the way up to the heart. It'll pump the blood for the patient, and then we can go ahead and fix the artery. We don't have to deal with, CPR or, giving, lots of medications to maintain the blood pressure. This will just pump the blood while we're going ahead and opening the artery with a balloon and a stent.
I think that's incredible, frankly. Mm-hmm. How new is this?
It's probably been around for, a couple of years. left ventricular assist devices were implanted surgically initially. They've been around since, the 1970s, the artificial heart.
In my mind, yeah, I thought of a large, relatively large, a device that would have to be, as you said,
right,
placed surgically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the way it was up until about 2 years ago. They had to do open heart surgery, and they take these tubes the size of maybe a garden hose, stick it in, the left ventricle, and then take another tube and stick it in the aorta and sew it on. And the blood, it would pump the blood outside the body from the left ventricle to the aorta. We wouldn't stop the heart, but it would assist the heart to pump. The only problem is it took open surgery, so you have somebody who's already has a sick heart, and then you're, putting a lot more stress on the heart by opening up the chest and then, sewing these tubes in.
And all the potential side effects of surgery.
Right, yeah, yeah. It was a really big deal, and surgeons tended to shy away from it because it was such a big deal. This is much easier. I mean, we go through an artery in the leg, And we don't cut the chest open. And all we do is place that little pumping device right across the aortic valve, and it pumps the blood from the left ventricle into the aorta, just like the surgical left ventricular assist device would have done.
So this is guided by some kind of imaging as well?
Yeah, x-ray. Well, we call it fluoroscopy, so it's like real-time x-ray. We watch the tube going up, and we can localize placement. Also, the monitor tells us exactly where the placement is, across the aortic valve, so it's in the correct position, so we're not just pumping the blood inside the heart without it going to the aorta. We make sure that, the one end is inside the left ventricle, sucking the blood out, and then pumping it into the aorta. So.
What's amazing to me is that, as I said before, it seemed like such a major undertaking, and it was never really for long-term use. Is that correct?
No, yeah.
And this is not for long-term use either.
No, definitely not. I mean, the manufacturer's recommendation is 6 hours. But some patients have had it for longer. I think the longest that I've heard was about 32 days.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
How is it powered, if you don't mind my
It's
asking.
Powered by electricity. So it's pretty well just a little turbine that turns very quickly. It's kind of like a jet ski. It pumps,
But I mean, what's the source of energy?
The source is from the monitor, and it's plugged into the wall, yeah. And there's tiny cables that go up to, through the catheter.
It could stay in there for a long period of time. It's not like it's a battery that would run out.
No, it's not a battery. Yeah, it's not. The device itself is actually connected to a monitor, which, gets a source from, electricity.
So similar. I mean, you obviously do catheterizations all the time, in which you do this very thing, where you basically go into the artery, up to the heart, and you figure out what the status of the heart is.
Yeah, so pretty well what the device allows us to do is it gives us time to do the procedure. So if the patient comes in cardiogenic shock, we can go ahead and do the procedure, open the artery. Generally, they do recover very quickly within a few hours, so the tube can be removed. The other case is the type of patient that has a very weak heart muscle at baseline, and then we're doing an angioplasty procedure where we pass a balloon through a tube down into the coronary artery. And when the balloon is inflated, it blocks the blood flow down the coronary artery temporarily. The only problem is somebody who's got a weak heart muscle would probably not tolerate that. We'd provoke cardiogenic shock.
So let me just make this clear. You do the angioplasty to open some of these vessels.
Right.
But the heart being so weak, it couldn't withstand the procedure.
Yeah.
So you support that weak heart with this device.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's pretty well the majority of the cases that we've done are people who have very weak heart muscle. They generally have several arteries that need to be opened. And if the risk of inflating a balloon and blocking the blood flow down one of these arteries, even temporarily, is very high, that we could precipitate, a drop in blood pressure, cardiogenic shock. So we insert the device beforehand and then go ahead and do our angioplasty procedure and throw in the stent. That's a metal coil that kind of pops open, holds the artery open. We don't have to worry about the patient's blood pressure fluctuating, about them, developing heart failure or other, terrible problems during the procedure. We can just go ahead and do it.
Is this being done in other places in New York State or elsewhere in the country? Tell us about that.
Well, we're the first in Central New York to be using it. We've done 5 up until now. We started in June. It's not very popular in New York State. It tends to be more popular outside of the state. I have some of my former trainees who are in the Midwest who do it quite often, maybe once or twice a month.
Wow.
On high-risk patients, yeah.
But our center, or your center, the cardiac catheterization unit here at Upstate, sees a lot of high-risk patients?
Yeah. Cath lab here has had the highest acuity rating in the state for several years, at least probably since I've been here.
What does that mean?
That means we have pretty well the sickest patients in the state. A lot of patients that come in with heart attacks. Approximately 40 to 50% of our patients that come in are coming in with a suddenly occluded artery causing a heart attack. And those are much higher risk than your stable patient that comes in from home to get a procedure. we tend to have a lot of heart failure type patients who come to us. I mean, we have people who specialize in heart failure. And we tend to, you know, need to do procedures on those type of people.
Well, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's amazing that you're seeing all these very difficult patients and that you're using a device that to me is like, you know, light years ahead of anything I've ever heard of. Mm-hmm. Very exciting stuff. And I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us. My guest has been Dr. Hani Kosman. He is the director of the Cardiac Catheterization Laboratory at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate's Literary Journal, with this week's offering from the Healing Muse. I thought we'd try something different today and do one of our humorous pieces. We often receive funny notes from our readers and writers. This one came in the mail from Canada. Ron Ruskin is a psychiatrist, and I'm sure he has dealt with many patients who have hypochondria, fear that they have every disease in the book. Well, Ron remembers when he was a medical student, and he sent us this essay. It's quite common in medical school that young students start to fear they too have every disease they're studying. This piece of his is called Dread, and I will just read some excerpts. I stood at the head of our dissecting table and slowly unrolled the white shroud from the cadaver. A man lay flat and stiff on the table, his skin darkened, thick, and tight about his joints, so that his knees and elbows seemed unnaturally polished and large. "Shall I take the plastic bag off the head?" I asked an anatomy demonstrator. "That will be unnecessary. You will start dissection on the axillary fossa." The axillary fossa. I had to check my anatomy book. That's the armpit. That was where we were to begin. At first, there was just Callahan and I, one on each side of the cadaver. The next day, we were joined by a rosy-cheeked, stocky fellow from Calabria, whose name was Francesco Basso. We called him Franco. Later in the week, we were joined by our fourth partner, Lisa Berg. She had flaxen hair and blue pastel eyes. She told us she felt anxious about being around cadavers. We named our cadaver Clive. During the first week, Lisa developed shortness of breath. Her heart twisted in her chest. When we lifted the white sheet off Clive and started dissection, Lisa confessed her period hadn't come. "Yeah, well, I'm going to be the first man to have twins," Franco chuckled. "Please," Lisa said, "I am not pregnant. I'm not even having sex with anyone." Callahan put down his scalpel. "Well, I'm not feeling well either. I've had dizzy spells this week. My neck has been stiff. I've had headaches for 2 weeks." Franco said, "Headaches?" "The pain, it comes and goes," Callahan said. "It's getting worse." "I've had headaches for weeks too," Franco said. "Meningitis. It could be meningitis," I told them. I covered Clive up with the white sheet. We leaned over him. This was week 3. I whispered, "Clive might have a lethal infection. I don't know where he got it or how it's spreading or where it's coming from, but I feel sick. I think that the infection might have killed him." "You have symptoms?" Franco asked. "Stomach pain on my right side." "That's your liver," Lisa said. "Do you have other symptoms?" "Burning on my right side." "Which side is my appendix on?" "It's on the right side in most people," Callahan said, "unless all your organs are reversed. Then it's on the left side, and your heart is on the right side." That afternoon, I went to the campus doctor. I didn't tell him, though, about my spider fear. I have had this crazy fear there was a huge spider under my bed. Each night, I check the sheets, the closet, and the mattress to make sure there is no spider. I have been doing this for years. The doctor listened to my heart and lungs. He took my blood and urine for testing. Franco confessed in week 4 he was losing his hair. I had dreams now my teeth were falling out. At night, I lay in bed and heard my heart pounding in my chest. The blood swooshed in my ears. I wanted my heart to stop so I could get some peace and quiet. But then my life would be over. We were all dying. There was no way around it. The question was how soon death would come. Would it be fast or slow? Would it be agonizing or painless? Would it come when we were awake or at night when we were asleep? We huddled over Clive and shared our symptoms, the terror of heart disease, the panic of brain tumors, meningitis, hair loss, multiple sclerosis, Hodgkin's disease, a bruise which might blossom overnight on our skin. In the second month of class, Callahan found the answer we were looking for. It was in a psychiatric test and described a condition in medical students who believed they were experiencing the disease under study, a form of hypochondria. Nothing was written about the disorder, yet all my classmates suffered for it. Like Clive and formaldehyde, the condition lingered all that first year in medical school.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's Health Link on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we explore what personalized cancer care really means and how patients with Parkinson's disease can live active lives. If you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. And don't forget, if you missed any of today's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website, healthlinkonair.org. That's all one word, Health Link on Air. Health Link on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio, produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.